Blog Talk Radio.
We are go for liftoff in T-minus 30.
Hit the record button.
Sorry about this. I was lost in space somewhere until I got here. Good morning. How you doing? Yeah, Ian Harvey, right?
Ian Harveystone, yeah.
Yes. Yeah. Okay. This is a rough start, but as usual, this is Italo from Italo's Black Radio. Welcome to the show. And the reason that we're here today is because we all aim to be in this good place, right? After we leave this earth, and then we end up either in the good place or the bad place. So this is the whole synopsis of the show, The Good Place, where Kristen Bell, the character of Kristen Bell, she basically wakes up. Is the first scene that you see in the first season one. And she's suddenly in front of this mural that says everything. I don't know if it says that everything will be okay. I forget what it says. Mm-hmm. Everything's fine.
Yeah.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
She's in this waiting room. Right. And so she meets Ted Hudson. I'm forgetting every single people that are in the show. Ted Danson, he's basically there to welcome her.
Yeah.
Okay. Okay. So for those that haven't seen it, just to let you know, this show that I'm doing today will be exploring the themes of the show. But in doing that, we may have to spoil the show, the plot. So if you haven't seen the show, if you haven't seen The Good Life. There's four seasons of it. There's tons of hours that I spend watching the show, not because of this particular podcast, but because it was such an interesting show, and that's why I wanted to do this show today. But because it's not just a comedy, I understood early on the show, this is a very serious comedy, really. Funny, but in a brainy kind of way where it makes you think, it makes you realize, like, hold on a second, this is very deep. And so I was like, okay. So anyhow, welcome to the show. And if you haven't listened to, if you haven't seen the movie, the show, stop this podcast now. And then when you've seen four seasons of it, then come back to this podcast and then we can go from there. How's that? And anyways, anyhow, so let us, Ian, who is in the show today, he responded to my request for people that wanted to be in the podcast. And he said something really interesting. I'm like, okay, we have to have Ian in the show because he's teaching a class based on the characters of the show. right?
Yeah, I'm teaching a class in critical thinking, and as part of that class, one of the things that I've been doing is using elements of the good place to underline ethical principles. So we've just done a very heavy unit on ethics, and when you're doing ethics, you need all the laughs you can get. So one of the good things about the good place is that it gives them, it makes it accessible in a way that is not condescending, and is a really nice taste that most people will go, actually, I want to learn more about that. I want to follow that through.
Right. So what made you take these characters from a fictional TV show, a comedy, you know, which is usually not seen, it's seen very lightly, you know, usually comedies are like, oh, well, that's just a comedy. But what made you think, like, wait a minute, you're saying something that rings true. And I think one of the characters that you're talking about is she meets the first character, she meets his, or her soulmate, that she's been paired with soulmates. Everybody has a soulmate. So Eleanor, who's played by, you know, Kristen Bell, she's paired with his soulmate of hers. And they're nothing alike. So tell us, what is your inspiration?
Well, I think part of it comes from wanting to convey to my students that the map is not the territory, that what you see isn't necessarily what you get. And with critical thinking, a lot of the time we try and step outside of our immediate problems so we can see the general overview. So we can look at meta-ethics, and we can step back and see in meta-normative ethics what applies to us without being in the grip of an emotion or without being too close to the problem. And by watching The Good Place, I mean, you're already taking one step away. So that's the first thing. The second thing is that the whole premise of the show is that nothing is quite what it appears. I don't want to spoil anything for anyone that hasn't seen the show. I know you've given them a warning, but you get quite comfortable in season one with what appears to be what, and that's flipped on its head entirely. And that's a valuable lesson, that a lot of the time we can get comfortable with what we believe to be our truth, that we believe to be our ideas, what we use through our own sense perception to be how we understand the world. And then something can happen which makes us step back and reevaluate what we think we know, and then to adjust our belief system accordingly.
Right. Because when I will spoil it. I'm sorry. I have to do this because otherwise I'll be like very vague, and I hate being vague when I want to like tell his story. And anyhow, but yeah, when she basically gets into her good place, and then they show her show her around the good place, and also her house in particular, right?
Mm-hmm.
And she's like, she's not a good person, and you can see flashbacks of when she was back on Earth and she was alive. She was not a good person, and she doesn't feel like she deserves to be in a good place, for obvious reasons that you will see in the show. She's very materialistic. She's very dismissive. She's just a bad person. So anyway, she meets this soulmate. His name is, in the show, is Chidi. Chidi is the name. So, and then he is an ethical, I don't know if he's an ethical professor or he teaches ethics. And,
yeah, he's a teacher of ethics. Chidi Anagonyu.
Okay. Right. And then, so she's, first of all, she's like, well, I have nothing in common with you. She plays it off like, oh, yeah, sure, I deserve to be here. And sure, he's my soulmate. And so anyways, that's the premise or the beginning of the show. But soon enough, you realize nobody's pair with the right person, like her. There's also the neighbor. I forget the neighbor's name, but she's a wealthy socialite. She's very, you know, chic and pretty and gorgeous. And then she's paired with this monk. And you're like, wait a minute. So that's when you start putting the pieces together. You're like, is anybody paired with the right person? Like, is this right? Is this, you know, and of course, Ted, he's the architect. And so you realize it's like, well, this is kind of like a matrix and it's mismatch everywhere. And the proportions of the property, that was hilarious too, when she's given this little property compared to the mansion that the other one gets. And I'm like, well, is that fair? Like, and so anyways, but yeah, going deeper into it, which I like about the show is when they go into the ethics portion, there was an exercise because he's teaching her about ethics, and there's the, you know, there's the, one of the theories is what would you do if you were in a train and you had to either, you have to either the track goes off rail, you can kill one person by going this way, but you suddenly have this, you know, but you're diverting from killing five other people on the other. So what will you do? That's one of the scenarios, which sounds easy in theory. And then sounds like a snap of fingers and you're there. And what do you do? And so I was like, oh, this is bad. But this is good because, sure, what are you doing in a real situation is different than what would you do in theory. Anyway, that's one of the things.
I mean, going back.
What do you think?
Going back to your point, I'd like to pick up on the point you said about, like, you know, she's a bad person. Is she though? One of the things I like about The Good Place is right from the start, we can see that Eleanor's not meant to be there. But then we look at what Eleanor does, and yeah, sure, she's a pretty nasty person. She does some things which are reprehensible. But is she a categorically bad person? You know, she's not a mass murderer. She's not like a torturer. She hasn't done any serious crimes. The amount of little things. It's the little things that she's done that has led her to be a bad person. It's not
right.
It's the sheer amount. And that's an interesting point that I think the show posits, which is what does it mean to be a good person and what does it mean to be a bad person?
Yeah. And also, when you get the flashbacks of the parents and how the parents were, you're like, well, no wonder, you know, she turned out to be such a callous and cold person because of her lack of parental guidance, to say the least. So you're right. Yeah, what makes her a bad person is the question, right?
Yeah, because I mean, she's not necessarily a bad person in the classic sense of how we would understand a bad person. But she's also, the whole of the show for me is it's watching her grow and realize that she is inherently a good person. But she's been put in awful applied ethical situations where perhaps she hasn't even given them consideration, due possibly to her background as well. But I mean, when you talk about the trolley problem, for instance, when they play the trolley problem out, the trolley problem is a classic ethical thought experiment. And in the show, the architect Michael puts them, rather than a kind of classroom exercise, he puts them very much into it in a real situation. And he goes through two very classic iterations of that problem. So the first one is five people on one track, one person on the other. And Chidi is such an indecisive character that he can't even come to a decision and is covered in corpses. And then Michael does this really nice number on him where he says, okay, they're not real people, but they experience real pain. So then Chidi's torn up with the idea that he is causing pain. And then they use the classic one of pushing somebody off of, well, they don't get to it, but there's the second level of that problem? Is there somebody on a bridge who is a bolted person that you can push off a bridge and it will, his bolt will stop the trolley, and should you do that? And most people won't push the person off the bridge. They will divert the trolley to kill a single person. Now, that's the same outcome. One person has died. But ethically speaking, pushing someone off a bridge is seen as taking more action. If you're a utilitarian and you believe that the best possible outcome has the best, most happiness for people. So in this case, like switching the lever or pushing the person off the bridge would do the same thing. The outcome would be the same. Five people would be saved. However, when we apply it, when we look at it ourselves, we think, well, I can't push someone off a bridge. That's killing someone. That's murder.
Right.
Pulling a switch. Right. Pulling a switch isn't murder. So the show puts these questions and holds them up to the light for us to look at in a fun and informative way. So that's one of the things I really like about the show.
Right, right. And then you go to season two, which I thought was the best of the four seasons to me.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, you're wondering, you're still learning about the characters in the first season. And there's many mm-hmm. funny things and comedic things going on. But the second season, I don't know if that's the second season, that's when she learns this is not the good place.
Mm-hmm.
And of course I'm ruining it for people. So again, sorry for those that are still listening. But she discovers that, hold on a second, we've been in this good quote unquote good place, but yet we're fighting and we were it's like Ted the architect was looking for them to meet to, I don't know what his purpose was, but I think it was to torture each other for all eternity. I guess that was the point.
Yeah. I think it's the end of season one where she finds out. That's where she, right at the end of season one where she works out that she's not in the good place. And then we learn that Michael is not who he says he is. He's not the architect of the good place. He's actually a bad
mm-hmm.
place architect.
Mm-hmm.
And he's doing what Jean-Paul Sartre said. Jean-Paul Sartre said that hell is other people. And I can't remember the name of the play. I think it might be Prince, it might be Wicklo. It's a play about three or four people trapped in a room, and they realize that their personal hell is being trapped for eternity in a room with these people. So it's developing the idea that what would happen if you were trapped for eternity with people that were so unsuited to you, wouldn't that be hell? We've got someone who is self-absorbed. We've got an ethics professor that can't make a decision. We've got a rich socialite that is vapid for the most part. And then we've got Florida boy, who's, you know, I love Jason. He's so funny.
I do. I do too.
Yeah.
Yes. Hilarious.
You know, who occasionally rubs his brain cells together and comes out with something, but, you know, is glorious in his practical comedy. And it's just the idea of these four mismatched people. And it's a genius idea. Like, you know, if you were going to put these people through the mill, what scenarios would you create to make them experience psychological torture?
Right.
So they do mention that it's not the standard torture, it's an experiment. It's for them, it's a thought experiment, just as much as it is for the human. It's the devils and demons saying, how can we do this better? How can we psychologically torture humans so they don't even realize they're being tortured, rather than just stabbing them? You know, there's a great quote he says that the Ted Danson's character says. He says, well, we could do it the other way. You know, we could roll out the old penis flattener, you know, and go back to what we do. And it's those little takeaway moments when you remember, oh my God, of course he's a demon. He's an evil demon.
Right. Yeah. And that's another funny part, because of course the idea of what we have of hell is way different than the show. And so when we see the good place turn out to be the bad place, you're like, wait. That's actually a really utopian society, I guess. Of course, there's clam chowder spewing from every fountain. That's kind of weird. and or you're eating ice cream for the rest of your life, and that's kind of odd as well, and you don't wonder about,
and
you know,
it's
other
not
things.
Even ice cream, it's breakfast.
Or yogurt. It's not even ice cream, it's yogurt.
Yeah.
Frozen yogurt. So, yeah. But yeah, and actually, what you just were just talking about something earlier, and it made me realize something. When we're pitted against some other people for eternity, right? And so I mm-hmm. kind of like look at my parents, where I was trapped in that universe that was very toxic for a while. And I was not in control over it, and I was trapped in hell, literally, like not even literally, like figuratively. But if I was stuck with mm-hmm. these two other people for the rest of my life, would that be hell? Yeah, that's a very good question, right? Would a quote unquote soulmate that you find, do you really want to commit to them for eternity? Is that mm-hmm. do you know how long eternity is going to be? Do you know you don't think it's going to drive you crazy to be hundreds of years, thousands of years, millennia? No. Of course. And so yeah, the show is amazing because it makes you think. Every episode was like, huh. Yeah. What would I do? And then there's Janet.
Yeah.
Sorry.
I was going to say, with the eternity thing you bring up about would you want to be a soulmate for eternity, I think one of the things the show brings up, which is quite nice, that one of the threads, is that the four main characters keep getting essentially rebooted. Every time they find out, Michael snaps his fingers and they go back to the beginning of the experiment. But everything he throws at them, every single time, the end result is one of two things. One, they discover that they're not what they think they are. And two, Chidi and Eleanor always end up getting back together. So in a way, what the show is saying, I think, is that there is someone that is there for you. In all of this chaos, in all of this pandemonium, there is someone out there for you. And that person is essentially your soulmate. You will find that person, come what may, whatever is thrown into your path. And that's a very optimistic element. Now, I'm British, so I don't do optimism to any great degree. I do like that. It does appeal to that, my sense of universal thinking that in this universe that we don't understand, that we can't understand, the one thing we might be able to understand is another human being.
Because the whole topic of soulmates, I do believe there are, yeah, there's obviously there's soulmates, of course, but soulmate doesn't mean that you have to be stuck with this person forever. I don't think that's the whole point. In my opinion, that's just my logic. Like, sure, you will find people that you're inclined to be with more than others, but you will learn from every other people that you meet, whether it's good or bad, quote unquote, good or bad. Each one teaches you something, and it makes you grow spiritually mm-hmm. and whatnot. So. Mm-hmm. Sure, she encounters all these different other characters in the show and in the little utopian place. It's like the Truman Show, basically. You're trapped in this world with X amount of people, and you end up meeting the same person. And then realizing over and over and over again, I don't even know how long they were in this, trapped in this world. I think it was 800 years. It was this odd number. You're like, what? 800 years? Oh my God, that's torture. But it was more torturous, I think, for Ted, or the character mm-hmm. that Ted is playing, because everything that he was throwing at them, it was like the coyote throwing stuff at the Roadrunner. is that you can never win.
Yeah.
And so that was comical.
Yeah.
And it was kind of like a Groundhog Day, kind of, it was like repeat, 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 repeat. Sort of like Freud, you know, Freud, how he says that we have to repeat things over and over because we don't learn the lesson. So you know, that's one of his philosophies or theories, right? That we have to do this over and over again because we don't learn the first time. So you're going to bound to repeat it.
I
think that's...
We only get 70 years if we're lucky on this planet, and we don't get a lot of time, really, if you express that as a period of time to learn from our mistakes. And what the show shows clearly to me is that these people are repeating, but every time something is changing incrementally, they're changing. Eleanor's getting better. She starts to become quite a well-versed person in ethics. Jason becomes a better person. The Ted's character, the architect, starts to change. The humans get under his skin. He starts to become a better person. Everybody, even Janet, who is a construct, you know, finds a new side to her. You know, Chidi
right.
grows to love, and Tahani recognizes her faults and has an aha moment and realizes that she's got the reason she's there and that she's got to change.
That was
one of the nice things is that they are in a constant state of change, and we don't get that time here. That's the problem. They don't really start living until they die.
Right. Actually, one thing you were mentioning, or you just made me think, when I was like, oh yeah, Tahani. And then Tahani story was interesting because, well, this is, I don't even know if it's what season it is. I will have to rewind. I think it's towards season 3 or 4 that she's about to go to the good place, right? And but she has to go through this hallway full of doors that contain people that she admired when she was alive, like Prince Charles and, you know, the royalty. And so it was such a good episode where she's going through these doors and she's not supposed to open the doors. She just says, just go through this hallway. And at the end of the hallway is the good place. It's very simple. And she's like, okay, sounds simple, but the interesting part at the end is like when she gets to the last door and it's her parents. I was like, wow, you're going to do that at the end? Oh my gosh. And then she opens the door and you're like, no. The only one that gets it is Eleanor, I think, is the only one that gets it.
there's an element there of our failure as humans to be able to follow through on things. So there was a very interesting experiment, I'm sure you know it, with Twinkies that they did, where they got a bunch of 5-year-old children and they put a Twinkie in front of them and said, well, I'm going to leave the room, I just have to do something.
If
you leave the Twinkie, I'll give you another Twinkie. You'll end up leaving with 2 Twinkies. But almost all of the children just waited about a minute and then stuffed it in them in their mouth.
Right. Yeah. Or the marshmallow, I think it was another one.
Yeah. I won it. Yeah.
I saw it. I was going to say something. I just forgot. But yeah, there's so many theories that are so... Every show throws like... different and I don't know anything about, well, I do know something about narcissism and all that stuff, but about ethics in particular, or the theories of ethics I was gonna say ethnics ethics, I don't know about it as much as you do, so it really piqued my interest. I'm like, I like to actually dive into ethics a bit, because I'm of course interested in that, and the whole psychology of it, the characters was amazing to me, and so what are your students say when they see the show?
Well, one of the discussions we have is, does the show tell us that there are moral codes that are universal to human beings? That it doesn't matter what culture you come from, it doesn't matter what background, is there a moral code that is morally absolute? Or must you always be a relativist and look at the situation that the person is occupying, saying, okay, you can't apply that code here because of the situation is X and Y. So we discuss a lot whether there is a code in us, for instance, that says, like, you know, it's wrong to kill someone. Do we inherently know that it's wrong to kill someone, or is that taught to us? And is that always applicable? So we have conversations like that, and then we take it down to applied ethics. Like one of the thought experiments that the trolley problem raises is, if you re-engineer that problem to say, okay, you're a doctor, and you have five people that are in need of an urgent organ transplant, and then one person comes in who's healthy. If you're a utilitarian, if you believe in the best possible outcome for the best happiness for the most amount of people, then you might consider cutting up that healthy person and putting that person's organs in the other five people. That way you've killed one person, but you've saved five. But, of course, a doctor has a Hippocratic oath that, you know, you should not hurt anyone. So that's an interesting kind of, you know, what should you do? And just in the good place, I think there's lots of little things which are absurdist moments that make me laugh, and we like to watch those moments as well. There's so much little moments they kind of slip in, and a lot of the time you have to pause and go back, or just that kind of zoom in on things. Like when the points values come up for who got into the good place and what they did and what can get you into the good place and what can get you in the bad place. There's some beautiful stuff, like mentioning Andrew Bowie in a Facebook post is a negative. watching the red chili peppers, being from Florida automatically gets you negative points.
Exactly. Like your intentions. What were your intentions? You did a good deed.
Yeah.
But was your intention, you know, or when you bought that apple, do you know how many people were slaves for growing that apple? And do you know how many people had to die in China and whatever? It's like, no, I just want an apple. Like, why do I have to be punished?
He's convinced for the first season that the reason he's in the bad place when he finds out is because he continued to use almond milk, even though he knew it was ethically unsound. Like, he completely ignores his biggest failure and locates a reason that he justifies. And I think we all do that as human beings, don't we? We all think, I think people think I'm bad because of this. And that may not be the case at all. But it's the little things as well that they say, like, you know, vanity plates is a negative. Taking your shoes and socks off on an airplane is a negative. And it's those things that they do, which aren't those things, that aren't big things, that make it accessible to a wider audience, you know, because you don't have to know anything about it. It's a good place. You have to know about what it's like to be a human being.
Mm-hmm. Right. And then, because is there really a good place? I mean, that was the whole question to me, and I'm like, is there a place like that? I mean, do you want to be in it? And it turns out, and I'm going to spoil it again, guys, so stop it right now, nobody goes to a good place for, it's been already over 500 years.
Yeah.
That we stopped going to the good place. And so the question is, does it matter what I'm doing? Does it matter to who? It should matter to you, but at the end, it doesn't really matter, I guess, is the point of the story. Just do it for goodness sake. Just do it because it makes you feel good. And you know, you shouldn't have to be rewarded for what you're doing. That's basically another thing. It's like, if you're thinking of doing the good deeds for a reward, you know, that's like,
then you're not doing a good thing. Yeah, you're not doing a deed which really has any moral value. Yeah. And for me it says what's important is what you do here. Stop thinking about the destination. Stop thinking about getting into the good place. And just how about trying to figure into what you do to living a good life. Because there may not be a good place. There may not be a bad place. People are so focused on the destination that they forget the journey to all intents and purposes. And I think there's a very famous teacher from the last century called Alan Wilson Watt, who uses the analogy of music and says that everybody's concerned about the destination. Everybody's told when they, you get an education, you get a job, you be a good person, you get into heaven, stuff like that. Everybody's so focused on the end result that you kind of forget to live that period in between. And he uses music as an analogy because he says that the universe is essentially playful. And if you think of it like that, music is not there to reach a destination. You don't play a piece of music to hear the final note. You play a piece of music to enjoy the whole piece of music. If the music was all about the destination, the people would only ever write finales, or an orchestra would rush through to get to the end. It's the content that's important. And I think that's what The Good Place, in a way, is trying to tell us. It's the content of your life right now that is important. It's not doing something with an aim for getting somewhere. It's doing something because it's important in the now.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And I really like that analogy. Enjoy. The universe is playful. The universe isn't really going anywhere to any great extent. So why should we plan to go somewhere? Why can't we just enjoy the majesty and the confusion?
right. And I like the fact that there's no one religion, telling you you came here because you were X, Y, or Z. I like that the show was not condescending in that sense. Because I thought of if they start with this thing, and they don't even mention the word God. I don't think they do, anyways.
It was
cool. It was it's not one right religion or wrong religion.
And the only person who did it right was that stoner on the wall. There's the picture in Michael's office of that kid. He's the only person that got it right.
Yeah.
In the history of the universe.
Whatever he did. Well, he was just high.
Not the priest, not the mullahs. Just this one dude that had smoked it up and went, what if?
And I think we've all been there, not high, but I'm saying when you have an epiphany, you're like, oh, I got it.
Yeah.
I think I got it. You know what I mean? Am I right? I think it makes more sense. We're never going to finish learning. We're never going to get, and then like you say, we only have, if we're lucky, we get 70 years. We get 50. If we're in the industry, we'll probably get 40. I'm already past that point, but honestly, I mean, if you think about it, the greatest, musicians have passed before the age of 27. And so, and Jesus even, And so, if we get lucky to leave that to that point, we were never going to stop learning up until the day we die. And perhaps if there's a reincarnation, like the show suggests, or does it suggest that? I don't know. no, it doesn't, actually. There's no reincarnation. I forget if there is.
No.
But you can be trapped in that place for forever as well. And what if you were to live that many years? How much would you learn? It's a good question too. Yeah, it's interesting.
He also shows that no one is above rehabilitation. That everybody has that can improve. That's the thing. Like Jason, even Jason, bless him, manages on one of the times to work out that it's the bad way. Hang on a minute, this is the bad place. And Michael's like, oh my god, even this is a low, this is a low. Even Jason
would. Right. If you figured it out, wow, I'm doing a great, I'm doing a bad job at, you know, masquerading. But yeah, actually, Jason said one thing that had me cracking up for, I don't know how long I was cracking up, because he was kind of, they were going to put everybody through an MRI to mm-hmm. the brain scan. And I think the technician was like, oh, I hope you guys are not claustrophobic. And then he says, yeah, what is that about? Is that a fear of Santa Claus? Because if you're Jewish, you shouldn't be afraid of Santa Claus. I'm like, oh my God, that's hilarious. Whatever. You don't even realize you're just funny. I don't even know why you're what your logic is. But yeah, he was just funny. And the jokes are hilarious. I mean, whoever wrote this show, I probably have to look it up. Michael Shore, I think yeah, is how you say his name. He's mm-hmm. so good. I don't know what else he did before. He did The Good Place. But he's just... Oh, Parks and Recreation. Okay. I need to look at that. Right. I haven't even seen Parks and Recreation or The Office I've seen. But, mm-hmm. Well, not the British one, I guess. The American one. So anyway, yeah, a little bit of credit.
Yeah, no, the writing is exceptional. And again, it's the little moments, just the set dressing as well for me, like the clown painting that you already mentioned, the fact that when the bedroom closes, there's a kind of clown's fanfare every time. The stairs that she only discovers later that lead up to the bedroom. She's like, you're kidding me?
The
fact that you can't swear in The Good Place, that, you know, the mother forking shirt. What the fork, yeah. It's so good.
Yeah.
It's so good. You love it if he does it.
The
flying shrimp.
That's
everything.
Sorry, I had a question. Is it funny to a British audience too? Or okay. I was just wondering.
I can't speak to the whole of the United Kingdom, but for me, it does one thing that a lot of British people like, which is there's some serious punnage. There's lots of puns, that, you know, like The Good Plates for the name of the restaurant. You know, there's all of the set dressing is very cleverly done, and there's so many different puns, and the jokes are so clear. And there's a lot of slapstick as well. Like Jason at his base is basically a clown. He's a Zanny, you know, from Commedia dell'arte. Mm. He's like Pedrolina, the clown. And whereas the others are a little more intelligent, but they're only like a couple of levels up from him. The power struggles that you see between them, the status thing, those things are funny across, I think, all cultures. We like to see someone with a big status get taken down. We like it when Tahani gets taken down. She's a great actress.
Mm.
She's phenomenal.
She is.
She's
gorgeous,
too. Oh, I mean, she's everything she does. And she's a great character. If you follow her on Twitter as well, she's a strong campaigner for women's rights. And she's used her clout to get the word out.
Is she British too? Because I thought she was British, but okay.
She is.
Okay. She's really, I mean, she's gorgeous, and especially when she became a centaur. Is that how you say it?
Yep.
When she became a horse. I was like, wow, look at your narcissistic centaur. And she didn't like her. It was hilarious. I'm like, of course you don't like her. It's you. To the 10th power. Anyway, Ian, we have to get going. We only have a minute left. So we're going to go back to The Good Place. But I do want to thank you for calling today. And let's do this again. Yeah. Let's see if, you know, there's another show that we'd like to talk about.
Sure. Thank you very much for inviting me.
You're very welcome. All right. Night. Or bye. Yeah. I'm still sleepy. Bye.
Be good.